So Wyoming Catholic College requires its students to commit to a technology fast. I just want to get that right out there right now. Our students, since 2007, have checked in their cell phones. There are no televisions or video games consoles on campus. There's no Wi-Fi in the dorms, and there's filtered internet access on the main campus. Okay, if you're already weirded out, I'm going to say something a little bit more radical. I think that if you are committed to the education of the whole person, as Wyoming Catholic College is, that at some level, every educational project needs to instantiate some form of this technology fast. Doesn't mean exactly the WCC form, but some form of a technology fast. Now, to get there, we have to make several claims. Some of them we've already made over the course of this conference. First, when we talk about persons, we're talking about minds. When there is not a mind, there is no spiritual potential for knowing the self, the world, and God, and therefore there's not a person. But when we're talking about human persons, we're talking about embodied minds, not ghosts in a machine, but an embodied mind that expresses its knowing in an intensely relational way, rooted in the body. And that takes on three main modes of knowing. First, the knowing in the body. I'm not going to come back to that. Second, the one we maybe more readily think of, knowing in abstraction. And third, a kind of knowing for the sake of acting, generally, on bodies. Now, each one of those modes can be thought of in different ways. Cardinal Newman describes it as a poetic mode of knowledge, this first knowing in the body, followed by a philosophical mode of knowledge, the knowing in abstraction, followed by a practical mode of knowledge, the knowing in action. Or we could take it with Jacques Maritain and talk about a poetic mode of knowledge in contrast to conceptual knowing, which can either be speculative or can be active or practical. Or we can follow Wendell Berry and say there's a sympathetic knowledge, a knowing in the body, a knowing relationally, that then is distinct from what Berry calls the purely rational, or the abstract on the one hand, and then the industrious or the active on the other. One way or another, I want to focus on that first knowing, the knowing in the body, what Jacques Maritain describes as the soul knows in the experience of the world, and the world is known in the experience of the soul. In poetic intuition, objective reality and subjectivity, the things we've been talking about, the world and the whole of the soul coexist inseparably. Sense and sensation are brought back to the heart, blood to the spirit, passion to intuition, and through the vital and non-conceptual act of the intellect, all the powers of the soul are actuated in their roots. Okay, that's very technical, exciting language, or not exciting depending on how academic you are. But the point we want to make is this knowing in the body is where the relationships that we're talking about that constitute the person arise from. Now, there are, according to Cardinal Newman, three modes of education that are going to correspond to these three modes of knowing. And he says the church has mastered these three modes of education at three different times in her history. This poetic education, or the education of the relational in the body, he calls the genius of the Benedictine or the monastic education. The abstract education he sees as culminating especially in the Dominican or the scholastic tradition. And then he says the Jesuits really nailed the practical, discernment, missional education. So in a very short talk, we don't have time to talk about the Dominican mode or the Jesuit mode. I want to focus especially on this monastic poetic mode of education. Now, when the monastics begin telling their poetic mode of education or practicing it, they do it in the context of a story, specifically the story of Adam and Eve. In unfallen Adam, this relational knowing that we're talking about was rooted in a direct experience of God that then radiated out into the body, and from that arose to more abstract knowing that we see in his naming of the animals, and into active knowing that we see in him tilling and keeping the garden. But after the fall, Adam and Eve lose this foundational relational knowledge, immediate knowledge of God. And so we see a series of broken relationships, a fractured self, a mutual hostility between persons and the world around them, a breakdown in communion between the human persons themselves, and a breakdown in relationship with God. So the monastic mode of education sees itself as concerned with responding to that first break, this rupture at this level. And therefore, it's a healing ministry of education that's cultivating this relational mind prior to working on the abstract contemplative thought or practical studies. And to do that, the monastic tradition does two main things. First, it goes into the wilderness. Following the example of the Israelites in Egypt, leaving Egypt, we go into the wilderness for education for three reasons. For purgation, for growth in virtue through challenge, and for the sake of a transformative encounter with God that creates a communion of persons, that constitutes a city in the desert. Now, when you're in the wilderness, you also do something. You do lots of things, but the important thing we want to focus on right now is you fast. And you fast for the same three reasons that we see that the monks go into the wilderness: for purgation from sin, for growth in self-knowledge and growth in virtue, and to dispose oneself to this transformative encounter with God that creates a communion of persons. And the monks see themselves as doing this by living as much as possible during the course of the fast as if they're already in communion with the heavenly realm. So that means there's a kind of maximal approach to fasting here. How far can you go to be living in an intensely angelic relational mode? And so in the Desert Fathers, we hear crazy stories about fasting, living in little hovels, eating maybe, you know, a piece of bread once a week, you know, an extreme kind of fasting that sort of terrifies us when we're only thinking of fasting as a purgative approach. But I want to stress, too, that that fasting is not merely concerned with food. For the monks, that fasting is also bound up with, as I noted, living in caves, living away from earthly artifice, a kind of fast from technology. Now we're going to return to why that may be the case. So Catholic education is fundamentally an extension of the mystery of the redemption to our fallen condition, which is why the Church has always seen education as one of the spiritual works of mercy, beginning with this deliberate cultivation of sympathetic or poetic knowledge as the ground for further education. We're responding to the need to go into the wilderness and to fast to reestablish relationship. So at Wyoming Catholic College, we take that very, very seriously and very literally. And beginning with our approach to poetic education, we bring our students into the wilderness, not just a remote town of Lander, far over 4 hours away from the nearest airport, but once even they're in this tiny little town in Lander, we send them further out into the mountains, and they spend about 10 weeks of their time at Wyoming Catholic College immersed in those mountains. But also, we take the fast very seriously. As I noted, we ask our students to fast from communicative technology because we're seeing the need for all three reasons that the monks go into the wilderness to fast: a purgation, a growth in self-knowledge and virtue, and a disposition to a transformative encounter with God and his creation and the resulting formation of a communion of persons. So first, the purgative aspect. We've already hit on this. The keynote last night was talking about all the terrible things that readily give rise in terms of our own sinful responses to the technologies that are available to us. We can talk about how technology facilitates pornography. We can talk about how technology facilitates addiction. We can talk, or even an addiction to the smartphone. We can talk about how the technology allows for, as we hear from the tracking that we know that the tech companies are doing to us, the commodification and objectification of the users. Every time we're on our phone, we're fundamentally being reduced to a cog in a wheel for spending money. And we're encouraged to spend more money. Our avarice is inflamed. We get addicted to that, like we're scrolling through on a little slot machine as we scroll through our Facebook feed. and then again have the possibility of both inflaming avarice, inflaming addiction, and inflaming lust. So of course, in those situations, you want to fast from technology. Put the smartphone away, break the addiction. Great. That's just a fundamental level. Just like if you're an alcoholic or if you're a glutton, you need to fast so you stop with those intense responses. So too, it's good to fast. And as we see in the statistics, increasingly young people from as young as 11 or younger are getting into addictions to their smartphones, struggles with lust, struggle with pornography, struggles with avarice. So base level, it's good to fast for that reason. But that's not the real fundamental reason for fasting from technology, though it's an essential starting point. We ask our students to fast for this growth in self-knowledge and growth in virtue. If anyone has tried to take the technology Sabbath that our keynote talked about last night, giving up your phone for a day, you probably quickly discover immediately checking your pockets because you imagine you felt a buzz. Or the difficulty of even doing things like standing in line or sitting in the bathroom and finding yourself anxious or bored or looking for something to distract yourself. The technological fast allows us to see in ourselves the unquiet, to see in ourselves the desire for distraction, to see in ourselves our concupiscences, our disordered passions. But it also invites us to grow in certain virtues. You know, again, technology expands our reach in really transformative ways that are really helpful. But at the same time, it has an effect on our own habits. Habits that we lose because we're constantly relying on the use of the communicative technology. So what are some virtues that we want to see our students growing in? One, memory. If you can't constantly Google everything, you do have to practice the art of memory to be able to recall it. Two, communication. If you are not able to just communicate with an emoji, but have to do something with your facial expression and words, there is a kind of virtue of communication that arises, necessarily. But more importantly, we see a presence to the reality around us. A presence to a reality that helps itself combat the individualism we've been talking about this weekend. It prevents us from making thought merely an act of ivory tower academics or merely a tool for purely pragmatic industrialists. You're grounded in a community and your thinking is contextualized. The conversations you have are there. And Joseph Pieper says, lastly, the giving up of technology ends a bit of distraction that enables us to learn to see again. Pieper already noted, this is well before smartphones or the internet, Pieper had already noted that we don't notice things. We don't notice the world around us. We don't notice people because there's too much. There's too many neon signs. There's too much noise. A technological fast enables us to learn to see. Anyone that has become as dependent as I am on Google Maps, not in Lander, Wyoming, but anywhere else, knows the experience. You don't notice the place around you because you're so accustomed to using the map to get you there. In fact, studies indicate that as they're using GPS more and more in certain Inuit cultures that are used to navigating the vast snowland plains of Canada, they're losing a kind of sense of place that normally helped them navigate as they rely more and more on the GPS. They're losing the sense of sight, the sense of awareness. So we want to develop this virtue. And lastly, so that's the purgative aspects of the technological fast, the self-knowledge and growth of virtue. But lastly, there's a kind of straining toward that heavenly life, a disposition to a transformational encounter with God and creation and the formation of a communion of real persons. That is at the root of our technology fast. In the narrative of the fall and the redemption, which we've already said formed the fundamental ground for the monastic education, the first instance of human artifice, of crafting raw natural ingredients to serve some human purpose, or we could say a kind of technology, are the fig leaves sewn together as a protective barrier against broken human relationships created by the fall. Now, the effect of this, just think about it. The moment we talk about putting on leaves, what's the effect of this? The effect of that, in part, is to camouflage the personhood of Adam and Eve, to make them look like plants. It was an effort not only to protect oneself, but to do so by abandoning personal relationships, not just with each other, but with their own bodies and the world at large. Irenaeus of Lyon describes this first response of Adam and Eve as an exaggerated response. Of course, we needed some kind of a response. We were no longer in Eden. And so God gave Adam and Eve garments of skin, garments of animals who have a sensitive relationship to the world around them. So, of course, we need to use our intelligence to create tools that help us navigate our relationship with each other, with animals, with the wider world of nature. But we need to do it in such a way that is not an exaggerated response at the expense of personal relational knowledge. To understand this tension in these terms of these two modes of responding to the world around us, I think Wendell Berry is a helpful guide here. Wendell Berry makes a distinction between paths on the one hand and roads on the other. He notes that paths are little more than a habit that comes with a knowledge of a place. They're a ritual of familiarity. The perfect adaptation through experience and familiarity of movement to place. It obeys the natural contours. Such obstacles as the path meets, it goes around. All right, so the path is fundamentally a relational model of interacting with space. But a road, Wendell Berry notes, embodies a resistance against the landscape. Its wish is to avoid contact with the landscape. It seeks, so far as possible, to go over the country rather than through it. Its aspiration, as we see clearly in the example of our modern freeways, is to be a bridge. Its tendency is to translate place into space in order to traverse it with the least effort and destroy obstacles in its path. And in the case of our modern freeways, such roads are designed principally to facilitate profit and expensive entertainment. So the communicative technology of the smartphone, which in a way just intensifies the tendency of television and the internet, makes our place into a merely digital space to be ignored. And we ignore it as a way of facilitating unrestrained profit through the commodification of the user, and offer in its place addictive entertainment. A break from communicative technologies gives us a chance to reestablish a place in which we're in real relationship, in which we can really encounter God giving us animal skins, responding to our fallen condition. And the effect we see at Wyoming Catholic College is that it's working. Our students form lively communities. We walk into the dining hall and there's not a screen in sight. We have an active dorm life. We have lower rates of depression than the national average. Still work to be done. Going back to a place with no screens does not actually take us to Eden. It only takes us to the 90s. which, despite my extreme nostalgia, I realize it's not perfect. There's work to be done. But the groundspring of the person is the sympathetic relational knowledge we've been discussing. It humanizes our abstract contemplation and our entrepreneurial zeal. In neglecting this first, we come to imagine thinking along the lines of the Cartesian dualism that my panelists talked about, an act of cold intellect inside a machine, and then we come to consider such thinking historically as a waste of time, and instead focus solely on what can be done with our thinking for the sake of acting. which when carried on has created the very situation of overwhelming addictive technology industry that we find ourselves in today. This return to an active cultivation of sympathetic knowledge as the groundwork for any Christian education remains a fundamental task of our day, and we need to at least do that in part by introducing some kind of a technological past. Thank you.